Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Trail of Tears. A damn good Marine. The Great Spirit knows what we need before we do. All that is required is patience to see the hand at work. This story is but one small example out of many. Adolescence is a difficult time for people. My own view is that it is the same the world over and through all time. Older cultures have rituals in place to aid and mark the passage of the young person into adulthood. The modern world has garbled this up beyond all recognition. Children are expected to be adults before their time, and adults are encouraged to remain childlike forever. This story starts in Texas and winds up on a mountaintop in British Columbia. I found one of my many teachers when I was working as a letter carrier. When I was going through my passage into the realm of adulthood, I was living in Texas. My country was at war. Most of the boys in my Oak Forest neighborhood were on average 6 years older than me, and I watched them get drafted to serve in Vietnam. Many of the guys who made it alive through their tour of duty came home with heroin addictions. Certain boys from certain families didn't have to go. The same methods of brainwashing the public in a country which is being used as cannon fodder were employed in the 60s as they were in the Boer War and all others. For my part, I did not believe in killing people who were not threatening my life directly or that of a loved one or friend. I knew the propaganda was just that. During the quote, Cold War, unquote, the flow of, quote, secret information, unquote, from the West to the enemy in the East was proceeding unabated and was aided and abetted at every turn. The whole affair was stage managed by bankers and other internationalists for the furtherance of very old agendas of control. The left wing and the right wing flap away, but it's the head of the bird that they are joined to which should be watched. The public where I lived was kept in constant tension and fear of the communist threat. From this fear, taxes were levied in unprecedented amounts to fund research and development of new bombs and planes to counter those of the enemy. In reality, which I saw firsthand when I first came to Canada, the enemy couldn't even feed itself and thus was sold our Alberta and Saskatchewan wheat at attractive prices. The horrific weapons they possessed were handed to them one microfiche at a time. There were men who regularly visited the Iron Curtain and even kept apartments there when it was forbidden to travel to these countries for anyone else. It just wasn't publicized, and their academic and business credentials made them untouchable at any rate. Much of the same tactics were used when it was decided to put into practice a next step in an old agenda, that of building up China to be the world's manufacturer. On the outside, it appears that they have lifted themselves out of the Dark Ages when in fact they have been given purposeful advantages of every kind to ensure their success, for a time. Their people will see when it's too late that they have been played like a fish by little men in bow ties. Back in Texas, I, being an adolescent philosopher, began to ponder on war in earnest. My graduation from high school was looming closer and I had no plans for attending university. So if the war was still on in 3 years' time, I would be in country. I tried to come up with a solution that I could live with. The solution of going to jail was not for me. No one should volunteer to go into a cage. I wasn't a member of a recognized conscientious objector religion, though I was a Christian, to put it in general terms. I knew that deep inside none of the guys wanted to go who had already gone. It was surreal to watch them being patted on the back by their parents at going away parties and told the usual tripe about being a man and making their fathers proud who had served in World War II and Korea. My own mother was a Dalton Trumbo fan and had arguments with the other ladies about the dubious honor of serving in the current war. This was a very unpopular view to take. I cheered her, but this going against the mainstream didn't fix my problem either. I also suspected that Johnny Got His Gun was a propaganda piece designed to help usher in a perfect utopian socialist control grid, a world where nice men looked after people from conception in a test tube to recycling at death. Most parents were quite happy for their sons to go kill in a jungle 15,000 miles away from their backyard, just like the parents today who are happy for their boys to kick indoors in the Middle East and blow away the inhabitants. This in itself was unsettling to me at 14 years old. I took up smoking near this time as I pondered these things. I wondered how many soldiers would be willing to fight and die protecting their actual homes and families from an actual invasion. I wondered if the commandment about "thou shalt not kill" had been altered from a possible original "thou shalt not murder." Obviously, there were situations in which a person may be given no other option than to kill another in order to preserve their own life or that of their spouse or other loved one. God couldn't have overlooked this. I wound up being moved to Canada before I would have been drafted. While this was not the reason my family moved, it was a relief of sorts. I felt a bond with all the poor guys from my streets who had to go. I felt a bond with those who did not return and those who returned as cash machines for pushers. In some piece of boy still stubbornly hanging on inside myself, I felt a misplaced guilt that I had been spared. I carried this pretty far beneath the surface at a place where I didn't let myself think about it too much. Yet it was there like a wrinkle on my Texas soul. It was illogical, destructive, and had more than a little Cherokee behind it. Many moons later, I had been working as a letter carrier and raising a family. I was paying lawyers, and I was paying landlords, and I was paying child support. I saw a new guy at my station who people said was a real mountain climber. I had always wanted to do that. One day, the fellow stopped me on my route and hailed me over to his beat-up, faded red Toyota. He asked me if he could give it to me, as he had heard I was without wheels. At this point, we hadn't been formally introduced. I thanked him and declined his offer on the grounds that I couldn't even afford the brake job that was imminent. That's how I met Al. He had been climbing mountains since he was about 17 years old, he told me. At work, we began to chat when we had time. I wanted to ask him if he would teach me to climb mountains. One day, I brought some photos of some places I had hiked to, and I asked the maestro if he would take me along on a real climb, and he asked me who had taken a particular picture that I had handed him. I told him I had taken it. "Mike, you idiot, that's Mount Mache Glacier, a real mountain. So is this other picture. I know all these mountains. You've already climbed some mountains." I was flabbergasted. The pictures I had shown him were from places where I had stopped my car without any previous planning or equipment and went for a little walk uphill to relieve some stress and sniff around the woods. I counted none of it as official mountain climbing. After many weeks and months with nothing more said, I received an invitation to accompany my new friend and his wife and one of their close friends to climb the Black Tusk. The Black Tusk is a core of an extinct volcano whose softer rock has worn away over the years and left a column of black, friable stone thrusting 7,700 feet skywards. I was elated, a real mountain at last, and in the company of a real mountain climber. The golden morning came and I met Al and his wife at their townhouse. We drove the hour or so to the base of the hill in Garibaldi Park and met the other friend, a farmer from the valley. It was a magical day. One of the things that happens when people climb mountains is that all the crap in a person's system, be it physical, mental, or otherwise, is cast into the furnace to provide energy to continue. As we ascended, all the toxins in my body and blood worked their way out in sweat. The mental toxins came next, and though subtle, they popped up in all of us present. Al had some daddy issues, as I had, and though we didn't chatter, we did talk in spurts, as this was the first time we ever did something together, and outside of the work floor, we hardly knew each other. One of the emotional burps that I belched up at about 6,000 feet was quite a surprise to me. I realized that I felt guilty for not having gone to serve in Vietnam as many of the boys in my Houston and Baton Rouge neighborhoods had. We talked about it as we huffed up the grade. Al had something similar that he had made peace with, and before we got to the part where we were stepping in fine volcanic dust and slipping backwards 2 feet with every foot of gain, I let this guilt come to the surface in my conscious thoughts where it had to fend for itself against rationality instead of festering like a bag of shrimp shells in a garbage can. At the near top was the exposed column. It was very cold up there and the crack we had to negotiate was notorious for falling rock. I got the honor of going second. I only remember that I reckoned that anyone can do anything with proper training and equipment, attitude and desire. Although I am terrified of man-made heights, I have no fear of God-made heights. I scampered up like a squirrel. The others joined me, and I got to go down first after our brief rest on top in the howling ice on top. I was a few hundred feet down the crack and had veered way off onto what I would call the apron of the mountain. If I could have seen where I was in the mist, I would have frozen in panic. Al saw what I had done, and in the most casual of tones suggested that I traverse a wee bit to the left. I happily and immediately complied, as I was being watched by three real mountain climbers, and I didn't want to look like a fool. When the party was 100 feet below where I had been when corrected, Al stopped and showed me what he had meant. It was a horribly exposed bulge that would have dropped me a couple of thousand feet if I'd gone a few yards further. I made several mental notes. We went to a pub in Squamish after the climb, and as we watched some local loggers playing pool, Al asked if I didn't feel superior to those mouth breathers and suggested that I go start a fight with one, as he probably deserved it anyway. I didn't know if it was a test of my character or a prescription for my own well-being from one who knew some of my trials firsthand. I used to live in Squamish, and I was on home turf in a way. I could see no reason to lay a finger on someone who hadn't wronged me in any way, and I said so to my group. They quaffed their beers, and we left in good spirits. Al told me later that of all his climbing friends, his wife had liked my company best. I was very honored to accompany Al several more times. After several more trips with my teacher, I struck out alone and climbed all the mountains in the Lynn watershed in North Vancouver. I took my own sons and my wife when she was still frisky enough to do it. I have taken sisters and nephews as well. One local mountain here is Grouse Mountain. It is a ski mountain and has a tram from the base to the chalet at the top where one may take ski lifts to the actual peaks. It's around 3,000 feet tall, and over the years it became a popular training exercise to hike up underneath a tram, getting a great workout at the same time as saving cash on the ticket. In the old days, anyone who did this grouse grind was given a free ride down. I used to do this on my way to climb some of the peaks in the watershed beyond, such as Goat Mountain, Little Goat Mountain, and Crown Mountain. One day, I was just topping the last few yards onto the shelf of land that houses the chalet, and it was the height of tourist season. I wormed my way through the crowd to line up my ascent of grouse off to the side of the lift and then head off northwest to climb Crown. It was an easy go from the chalet to Grouse Peak, and once there, I usually stopped to sip from my thermos and get attuned for the coming climb. A big man and his little wife walked up to me holding hands. They had just gotten off the lift and were getting ready to take pictures of the peak. I was pulling on my first layer as I had come up the grind shirtless so as not to ruin my clothes with sweat. The man was about in his mid-50s, and as soon as he spoke, I knew he was either from Texas or Oklahoma. He was weathered, neatly shaved, and if you'd have hit him with a mop handle, it would have snapped in two. "Son, I've been watching you, and I want to know how you got up here." "I climbed up, sir, from the bottom of the tram. Now I'm heading for that mountain over there." I pointed out Crown Mountain and the camel-shaped rock next to it. "Son," he said, looking me straight in the eye and talking very slow and purposeful, "I'm a drill instructor for the U.S. Marines, and I want to tell you that you would have made a damn good Marine." I thanked him for the kind words, and we shook hands. His wife snapped a photo, and I was off. That piece of misplaced guilt that had been buried in my psyche, then unearthed on my first climb with Al to become a little devil on my shoulder, had just had its ass thoroughly kicked by a southern drill sergeant. It couldn't have happened in a more perfect place, the message couldn't have been delivered by a more perfect messenger, and I have never been nagged by that silliness since that day. Guys who climb together don't always, nor do they usually, socialize together. They may not even keep in touch between climbs, yet they trust their lives to each other in the bush. My teacher Al had a daughter and moved to a different station. I never saw him again, and I heard through the grapevine that his wife had passed away. As far as I know, he is still active in search and rescue. I know he has seen the hand at work in his own life. I know that he does what he must. I know that the sight of his headlight coming through the mist has been a blessed, life-changing event for some poor souls lost in the rocks and trees. Al, I know that you would have made a damn good Marine. God bless you, brother and teacher. There's a mountain in my heart, and you and your daughter are sitting on top of it, smiling. Hawes, and you're listening to Trail of Tears. Tiptoeing into the Extraordinary. A few days prior to the anniversary date of my 29th year as a letter carrier, I began a new route. The territory was some ground I had covered before. 2 blocks of small business had been excised and 12 blocks of residential had been appended. The old route had measured out at 14 kilometers, and I decided that the new route would not require a pedometer. My calves began to cramp at 15 kilometers, and there was still well over 20 blocks to go. 6 days shy of the anniversary, which was to occur on the 29th of October, I was heading west on 29th Avenue, and I spied an adult female coyote. She stood in the crossroads a block away on 28th Avenue, and after checking me out, she walked off to the west. There was a tall young man about a half a block away fingering a cell phone who appeared to be following her. When I reached the end of my westward run, I saw her heading east, and the young man was still tailing her from a half block distance. I walked over to speak with him. He was about 20 years old, tall, and working nearby on some residential construction. He had phoned the police, the animal control authorities, and was keeping visual contact. The coyotress was keeping the normal coyote safe buffer distance of about 12 yards between her and the young man. "I'm an Inuit," he said. "I know coyotes, eh? She found an apple tree in a house with chickens. She'll stay in this area." "I'm a Cherokee Swede," I said. "Coyotes know me. This is my territory. This is also where I earn my apples." The coyote stood 40 feet away in the middle of the road, munching on a hard green Granny Smith apple and listening to our every word as her ears rotated in 360 degrees. Her mama didn't raise no fool. I worked for 4 blocks to my turnaround on Canby Street and began the westward jaunt down 28th Avenue. Way down at the end of this run, I saw the young man putting some underground sprinkler tubing in the yard of a new house. Coyote was gone. I stopped to ask if the authorities had collared the girl. "No. They said if she's not showing aggression, they won't catch her." When I got down 2 blocks east of where the fellow was working, it was time for my sandwich. I was on the 600 block of 28th Avenue, and it was on the crest of a north-south ripple that runs through the geography of this region. It was a fine Indian summer day with achingly beautiful cobalt skies, offset by the gold and jasper of the leaves of the tree-lined street. I sat on the north side curb and dug into my tiffins. As I poured out some warm coffee, I saw the coyote. She was directly across the street under a small maple. She was just licking her teeth after another delicious Granny Smith apple and circling the spot where she obviously intended to lay down. It was noteworthy as we were only 25 feet apart and it was broad daylight. I ate my sandwich with the gusto of a starved wolf and I began on my daily apple, a gala. Now it was smoke time. I began to ponder many things that had been working their way from my deeps into my shallows. I pondered how much longer I should or would walk the streets delivering mail. I pondered the change in landscape of my city. I pondered the fact that after 29 years I was earning $2 an hour less than when I began, after adjusting for inflation. I pondered the fact that everything in my view would sooner or later be razed to the ground and rebuilt 4 stories deep. I pondered the fact that the walking time portion of the Canadian letter carrier's job had doubled since I began. I wondered if this would prove to be my last route. All the while I watched the coyote. She looked a little worn out and her fur was still in summer mode. She worked her large ears incessantly monitoring every sound. I could see that she had learned to filter large batches of repetitious city ambience just as I had. I named her Apple Annie. She kept looking west as if waiting for something to appear. I told her in a soft voice that since we were having lunch together, we may as well sit together. I rose up and crossed the street. I sat down on the other side of the little maple and could have easily reached over and stroked the fur between her ears. We were both leaving the realm of the noteworthy and tiptoeing into the extraordinary. Apple Annie was a normal wild animal with full instincts. She had a small circular wound on her left buttock, which had mostly healed, and she walked with no limp. She wasn't drooling, mad, or dazed. Her teeth were clean and shiny, her eyes were as bright as the Korean gal at the SkyTrain coffee bar. Her pads were sound and her nails were straight and strong. There was one thing I noticed right away, though, as soon as I sat beside her. Annie was tired. I mean, the girl was staying awake by Herculean effort. I knew the feeling well. After every restructure, a letter carrier does about 2 weeks of 12-hour shifts, and there is much to monitor if one is to cope. I rolled another smoke and sang her a little Cherokee song I learned from Rita Coolidge. I told her that I would take another 15 minutes on my break and watch over her. She kept looking west, and soon her eyelids drooped. I continued to talk softly, and her head nodded just like mine used to do when we had math class in Louisiana and there was no air conditioning. She fought it and resumed her vigil, just like her maker intended and her mother had taught her. I reassured her that I wouldn't let anyone harm her. Across the street, I could see an old customer watching from his living room window. His eyes were wide. He was a nice old man whom I had spoken to several times when I was his mailman before. He had met the Queen and had never quite gotten over it. He'd been on a tour with some old veterans to the beaches of France. One of the entourage was Smokey Smith, the eldest vet then living. This man was wheelchair-bound and was a chain smoker. As the August gentleman stood on the strand remembering the gunfire, the Queen's escorts brought the old lady down a hill to address those assembled. According to Mr. L., Smokey ditched his cigarette when he saw her coming. Elizabeth walked right up to him and told him to go on ahead and light up another one. This noblesse oblige was just a cat's ass as far as Mr. L. could see. We had spoken also of raccoons, and he had related a story of trying to reunite four kits with their mum after their tree nest had fallen in a windstorm. He had shown me the spot on the yard where it all had happened. He had donned a welder's mask and welder's gloves and tried to scoop them up one at a time and ferry them to the other side of a retaining wall where the mother waited. His Irish description of the ensuing caterwauling mayhem left me in stitches for several days. He had a great respect for wild animals of any size. Mr. L. said I was the only man he'd met, save one, who knew of the danger of the black mamba. We had been talking snakes one afternoon, and I told him that a gentleman in the next block kept a 7-foot python. I had said that it was big enough to kill a man, but posed no danger to me when sunning on the lawn with a full belly. I told him that there was one snake that was never safe, and that was the mamba. It was the only snake I know of that will stalk a human with intent to kill. In other words, it will kill what it cannot eat. In Africa, people carry bundles of stuff on their heads if they have to pass under trees as a protection against this animal. Contrary to most every other snake, this one can raise its head off the ground to the height of a man's eyes when still and move forward with its head elevated well up off the deck. It's very long and of small circumference. It can outrun a man and it can climb like a monkey. Mr. L. had an English military friend who loved to trek in southern Africa. It was from this man he had learned of the mamba. His friend had once spotted a mamba crossing a dirt road while on a journey. He had set his compass due east immediately, marched 4 miles off his course, marched 4 miles north, and finally 4 miles west to rejoin his original track. Such was the necessary precaution to take for all those who knew. Mr. L. spoke of a circus that had come to Vancouver many years before I was born. The gypsies and carnies had set up along the railroad track right away that runs near Arbutus Street. The main attractions were a very large elephant and a huge anaconda. The snake was dubbed Methuselah in the adverts and posters. Its great size was attributed to its incredible antiquity. Mr. L. had gone as a boy to see the circus and especially to see the snake. He was suitably awed with the monster. After a week or so, the circus men pulled up the tent pegs to move on, and a curious article appeared in the Vancouver Sun the following day. It so happened that when the animals were being readied for transportation, Methuselah was discovered to be missing. It was never found, and Mr. L. said he had added a new clause onto his nightly prayers after that. Today, the right-of-way is known for the feral rabbit population and the strange absence of homeless people who seem to prefer dirty concrete downtown over the beautiful blackberry bushes, tall grass, shady trees, and ditches. As I continued to speak to Apple Annie, she looked directly at me and studied my face. She put her head between her paws, closed both eyes, and relaxed her radar ears. You never saw anything like it. I turned to Mr. L.'s window. He made a gesture of astonishment. Two Japanese ladies hurried down the sidewalk. When they got close enough to see that Annie wasn't a wolf and wasn't a dog, they pulled out their camera phones and began to squeal. Annie rose after only a 5-minute rest and walked off to the west. The next day, when I reached a relay box where I intended to rest, as it was nearly exactly halfway through the route, I set up my lunch on a low cement wall that ran along under a massive hedge. There was a red mailbox as well, standing next to the gray relay box. I had 3 bags of mail in that relay. I had just poured my coffee when Apple Annie appeared from an alley across the street. She walked up and lay down next to the mailbox, munching on a Granny Smith. I sat about 3 feet away on the low wall and ate my sandwich. She kept looking west. In about 15 minutes, a red truck swerved to a sloppy stop, and a bearded man and his chubby wife got out and started taking pictures with their cell phones. The man came up close, and his wife stayed about 20 feet away, as her maker intended and her mama had taught her. The man squatted on his haunches and started making the sounds you make when you're calling a dog. Annie looked at him and then looked at me. "Is it your coyote?" the man asked. "Nope." "Are you feeding it?" "Nope. She likes Granny Smith apples and chicken, while I prefer Gala apples and my wife's pork chop sandwiches. We're just having lunch together, is all." "Damn." The man kept making kissing sounds, extending his hand and snapping his fingers. Annie got up and walked off to the west. He took one last photo and then drove away. When I reached Mr. L.'s house later that day, he was waiting in his yard. "So, you're back on this route?" "Yep." "Michael, now tell me, my boy, is that your coyote?" "Nope." "Are you feeding it?" "Nope. She has her own apples. I can scarcely feed myself enough to do this new improved route." "Her mother mustn't have taught her to kill. It's extraordinary. I saw her go to sleep beside you." "She knows how to kill chickens. Don't fool yourself. That's a nighttime job." The following day, I didn't see Annie, and I haven't seen her since. Mr. L. inquired once more about her welfare, and I told him of her disappearance. He shook his head and said it was an altogether extraordinary week. I reminded him of Methuselah. I'm part Irish, and I couldn't resist the joke. There are a few really precious things in this world. There are fewer priceless things. On my trail, I've been fortunate enough to encounter and recognize one or two thus far. Near the top of this small list is the unsolicited trust of one living creature freely bestowed upon another, particularly the trust of a female or a child extended to an adult male. Above this, the trust of a wild creature extended to any other species. Thank you, Apple Annie. Vaya con Dios. Remember Algeciras? My taxi driver had this to say when I told him the story later in the week while en route to my AM drop. "Mike, there are 2 only possibilities for this Coti incident. Maybe she bust your relative come to visit from other life."
"What's the other possibility?"
"That this Coti know that you are holy."
"Or maybe she was just waiting for me to drop my last letter."
"I do not think so. She must tell something for you."
So, There are as many explanations as there are traditions, religions, and expectations. I have my own interpretation. There were questions on my mind that week in particular, and I was seeking clarity and confirmation of my own inchoate decisions. Annie provided exactly what I sought. I simply had to remember that the Creator had made her a trickster. She'd been looking to the west and walking always to the west. She couldn't help it. This is the direction of introspection and sunset. It was likely the direction from which she had been shot or bitten. The east is the direction of new beginnings. Such was her message given in her own way. I knew this was to be my last route.